it takes to become an artist is to start doing art mindfully. That's just one of the things I learned when I spoke with Ellen Langer, the mother of mindfulness. A recipient of multiple awards, including a Guggenheim Fellowship and the Liberty Science Genius Award, Ellen Langer is also the first woman to be tenured in Harvard's psychology department. Over nearly half a century, she's authored more than 200 research papers and 13 books, studying not only mindfulness theory, but the illusion of control, decision-making, and aging. I spoke with her about her most recent book, The Mindful Body, and how mindfulness not only improves the way that women live, but also the way we lead.
I'm Ellen Langer, and this is a lesson on mindfulness.
I want to know what your first memory of being creative is.
This is actually interesting. I was working as an undergraduate as a research assistant for one of my professors, and I came up with something that she didn't know. And for her to explain that, she said, "Ellen, you're so creative." Now, I had never considered myself creative because to me as a child, that meant those people who could draw or who played a musical instrument. Now, the same semester, I had another professor who gave us some assignment for a paper. Rather than writing a paper, I decided to write a program textbook. And so I got back the textbook and says, "You've got so much chutzpah." And so in the same basic period of time, to be told I had chutzpah and I was creative gave me permission to just do whatever I wanted to do, essentially.
I love that.
So I changed my view of myself. And then with that change, I paid attention to how silly so many of the rules that people were blindly following.
Yeah, so you started painting one summer, just randomly. What made you decide, I'm going to paint?
I was in Provincetown, and it just rained and rained. I had never had a summer like that. And I went to the hardware store, and I ran into a friend who was an artist. And I ran out of things to say to her. So I said, "I'm thinking of taking up painting." I have no idea why I said that. She then dragged me to her studio, gave me two tiny canvases, and she said, "Just do it." Okay. A day later, I had to deliver something to a very established artist. And again, I wasn't sure after a sentence or two what to say. So I said, I was thinking of taking a painting. She said, "Make yourself an enormous canvas and just let yourself go and do it." And so there were no rules. Then I went back. It was still raining, so there was no tennis or long walks on the beach or whatever. And I found a shingle and I just painted on this shingle. Now, what was interesting to me as a psychologist was that I painted a woman, girl, who knows, on a horse riding through the woods. And the fact that the content was about wood and I was painting on wood seemed to be interesting to me.
But wait, a horse, a woman on a horse,
on a
you
horse.
Didn't know how to do that? How do you know how to do that? Having
you have a sense of what a woman looks like, what a horse looks like. Wow. I'm not suggesting that anybody else who looked at it would have seen a woman on a horse. That was my intention. But I loved it. And then I went to the art supply store to see if it was any good. And it was interesting to me because I knew just because of who I was, whatever that means, there are some people who would say it was good no matter what. There were just as many people who would say it's bad no matter what. So I wanted an unbiased view. And I asked this person who sells canvases, should I paint over this? And actually, that would make sense that he would want me to buy a canvas instead of he expressed some liking for it. And then I was off and running. And it was very exciting because I would paint something. I would look at it, notice, and then see if what I did was true just for me or a general truth. So I then do a study and I went back and forth between these two evolving lives, myself as a researcher and as a painter. And since I don't follow rules, and partly because I didn't know any of the rules, so I couldn't follow them. It was a very expressive journey for me, and also very different kind of artwork. So I called it intuitive art. Now, I had a friend who was also an art collector who saw one of these paintings. She said, Ellen, there's something there. Now, don't go thinking you're Rembrandt. Okay, but then I thought to myself, no, I'm not Rembrandt, but Rembrandt isn't me. And then I thought that if I'm true to myself, no one can do a better Ellen Langer than I can. And it was just great fun.
So you painted horses for a long time, and then you moved to people.
Actually, I'm more dogs than horses, and always people there somewhere.
And always people. Okay, so when you moved to people, because I've been looking, I looked at some of your work online, which is beautiful. And again, this, because I'm so caught in the talent I don't have for painting, right? Or the definition of talent I don't have for painting.
Just be the best Kim you can be. You have a career, so you don't need to sell the paintings.
Right.
So just do it and have fun. And I found that the fun comes, oddly, as soon as you make a mistake. Now, if you make a mistake and then go forward, rather than try to correct the mistake, you're necessarily going to be mindful since you aren't planning on a mistake. And the research that we've done shows that anything we do mindfully versus mindlessly, so our mindfulness leaves its imprint on these products.
So let's talk about your definition of mindfulness.
Yes. Okay, so I've been studying mindfulness for 45 years. Mm-hmm. And people seem to think that mindfulness means meditation.
Right.
First of all, meditation is not mindful. Mm-hmm. It's not mindfulness. Meditation is a practice you undergo, presumably to lead to post-meditative mindfulness. Mm-hmm. What I'm talking about is different, not better works, it's just different. Mm-hmm. And it's immediate, it's not a practice. It's just a way of being that comes about once you recognize that you don't know. Mm. Now, in schools, our parents, and the work we do, we're often told this is how you do it and so on, as if those absolutes are real across all contexts.
You talk about the mind and body being one.
Yeah. So in the new book, this is a large piece of it, but by no means the only piece. The new book is The Mindful Body, Thinking Our Way to Chronic Health. And essentially, there's been a problem philosophers had and psychologists for forever. If you have a mind and a body, how do they speak to each other? How do you get from this fuzzy thing called a thought to something material called the body? And when I think about that, I say, wait a second, this is silly. These are just words. So even if it's just for heuristic purposes, to be helpful, and not literally true, although I think it's literally true. Let's put the mind and body back together. When we do that, wherever we're putting the mind, we're necessarily putting the body. And that gives a small idea to people of how much control we have over our health and well-being. So the first study we did was many years ago. We retrofitted a retreat to 20 years earlier and had elderly men live there as if they were their younger selves. So they would be discussing past events as if they were just unfolding, for example. So in as many ways as we could think of, they were now who they were. As a result, in a period of time as short as 1 week, their vision improved, their hearing improved. Now these are elderly men. You tell me when you've ever heard of an elderly man's hearing improving. Their strength improved, their memory, and they look noticeably younger. And that was very exciting in the beginning of a host of studies. I think if your audience is largely women, they'll love this next one that we did. We did this with chambermaids. Now, interesting, chambermaids are exercising all day long. That's what their work is. But they don't recognize that their work is exercise because according to the Surgeon General, who sits at a desk all day, exercise is what you do after work. And after work, they're too tired. So we have all these chambermaids exercising all day long, but not seeing themselves as exercising. If exercise itself is good for you, regardless of what they're thinking, they should be healthier than similar others who aren't exercising, but they're not. All right. Now what we do is we randomly take half of them and we just teach them that their work is exercise. Making a bed is like working at this machine at the gym and so on. We take many measures. At the end of this, we find the two groups, the one that sees their work as exercise and the work group that doesn't realize this. They're not eating any differently. They're not working any harder or less hard, what have you. Nevertheless, once they change their mindset and recognize that their work is exercise, they lost weight, there was a change in waist to hip ratio, body mass index, and their blood pressure came down simply from the change of mind.
With the mind body, because we often put spirit attached to it too. So I'm wondering, is there any context for spirit in the research at all, or does it contribute to mind? No. Okay.
Well, you know, it's not, and again, they're all just words.
Right.
And when one is mindful,
right,
one can describe you as spiritual. You're just going to be your best self.
So is that the same with intuition then? Because intuition for me is also looking at is what is different or dissimilar from a series of situations. So how does intuition play into mindfulness at all, okay, if at all, for you?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. We don't really know very much about intuition. Mm-hmm. But when you're mindful, you're picking up cues to which you're otherwise blind.
Right.
Now, if you don't have a name for those cues, you don't know where you're getting, you know, I don't like you. I don't know why I don't like you, but I don't like you. That's the feeling. It's not because nothing is happening. It's because I don't know how to
articulate it. Yeah.
But we shouldn't think that if you feel something is intuitively correct, that it's necessarily correct, because consider this example. You hear a song played and then you hear it again and again and again. Now, imagine somebody else sings it and it's a different rendition of the same song. It will feel wrong.
Right. Okay.
So our mindlessness can lead to the feeling of intuition. Mm. I think we need to trust ourselves, you know, not to the point where we ignore other ways these feelings could come about. Rather than waste your time trying to make the right decision, you can randomly decide and make the decision right. So you make a decision to take an action. Once you take the action, the game has changed. You know, right. So I can't say, should I go to Harvard or should I go to Yale? So if I randomly go, let's say, to Harvard, and let's say I'm not happy there, that doesn't mean I made the wrong decision, because I could have been more unhappy had I gone to Yale. But I can't now go to Yale because I'm no longer a first year student, right? So you can never find out. Now, what's most important for all of this is for people to recognize that outcomes are in our heads. They're just things that happen. They're not good or bad. So stress is not a function of what happens. Stress is a function of the view you take of what happens. If you see it as, oh my God, yeah, you're going to experience it negatively. But there's always a way that oh my God, might be the best thing in the world for you.
So what's the impact of mindfulness in the context of leadership?
What's interesting is that women, I believe, tend to be more mindful, because women have been taken to task for using conditional language. Take a position rather than seem on the fence with it could be, possibly, maybe, often. But those words all indicate that you're mindful, that you know that there are circumstances where what you're saying may be true, other circumstances where it may not be true. Mm-hmm. And this is very important, because when you're mindful, so you're actively noticing new things rather than thinking,
right,
that puts you in the present, makes you sensitive to context and perspective. And while you're actively noticing, the neurons are firing. And 45 years of our research shows that it's literally and figuratively enlivening. It feels good. It's good for you. Not only that, but when you're being mindful, people find you more authentic, attractive, trustworthy. Mm-hmm. Not only that, so it's good for your health. People like you more. As I said a moment before, it also leaves its imprint on what you're doing. So we have orchestras, for example, performing mindlessly or mindfully. We have audiences oblivious to the fact that it's a study, evaluating the music. And more often than not, people find the mindfully played piece better.
I think it's interesting, though, what you just said about women being taken to task for not being specific enough in their language, and that once you've named something, it is named. The allowance for the possibility that not all things are as we see them. I think we're living right now in a moment when some people are seeing things very different than what is perceived.
Yeah.
Right. Our perceptions are at odds with each other, and we're living two different kinds of realities.
Yeah. And the problem is that both sides think what they're saying is real.
Right.
And the more mindful you are, the more aware you are of, in some sense, multiple realities.
Right.
Let me just go back for a moment. So the way to be mindful is this active noticing.
Right.
But you don't actively notice when you think you know. Mm-hmm. So there are two ways to become mm-hmm. more mindful generally. One is you notice new things about the things you thought you knew. So when I started painting, to go back to that, if you had asked me what color are leaves, not in the fall, I would have said green. Then I start painting and I go, oh my God, there are hundreds of different shades of green, and it changes depending on where the sun is and so on.
Right.
So this one thing became
many things,
which gave me many more choices. Now, the other way to be mindful, and this is better but harder, is to just accept you don't know. So I know I don't know. I'm not afraid of not knowing. Everybody knows they don't know, but they think they should know. So they pretend or they stand back. But I know I don't know. You don't know. You know that. And I know that this guy who's trying to make me uncomfortable with his knowing that you don't want to do this, but I can emasculate him in seconds through a series of questions to make clear he doesn't know.
Right.
So the best way to be, I believe, is to be uncertain and confident. See, you stand tall because it's okay not to know. And when you don't know, then everything is new and exciting. Now, the interesting thing is that this act of noticing is energy begetting. So it feels good and you become energized rather than depleted.
But in a leadership context, being uncertain can be perceived as being weak, unknowledgeable. So
no? Okay. Because right now, when people are uncertain, they look
uncertain. Right.
They look, they but, when you're standing tall, I don't know. If I say it like that, believe me, you're not going to think I'm uncertain. In fact, you're going to take a step back and be scared of me. If you're strong and you're a woman and you're seen as, can I say, a bitch?
That's yes, please. Go ahead. We know it. We all know
and,
it.
And if you're weak, then you're not a good leader. So what's a woman to do? Let me tell you first a little study we did. So we took women and we were going to have them be male-like, forceful, female-like, sweet and loving, and mindful or mindless. And it turned out that when she was mindful, it didn't matter whether she was male-like or female-like. And so now another several things about leadership is that the smart leader knows she doesn't know. And so she's open to getting information from other people. But if that creates in your mind the image of, oh, I don't know, can you help me? Of course, you're not going to seem strong. But if you're standing tall, and this can be many different things. Kim, what do you think? The whole game changes. In this study that I did with symphony orchestras, as I said, this is about leadership, but it'll take a moment to get there. Mm-hmm. So one group is told, make it new in very subtle ways that only you would know. That's the mindful group. The mindless group is told, remember a time you played this well and just try to replicate it. So mindful is always something new, mindless, same old. We record it and people prefer the mindfully played piece. Now, when I was writing this up, all of a sudden I realized, and this is interesting, when we had people where everybody was essentially doing their own thing, you had superior coordinated experience.
That's right? Interesting.
And so it led me to think that the major role of the leader is to provoke the mindfulness in those being led. Mm-hmm. And you want to do that because, geez, sometimes this thing isn't what I think it is. And people bring with them all sorts of information that we ourselves don't have. So you want to be open to it. Women actually should be the best leaders, because they're most likely to encourage other people's successes. They're most likely to carry themselves confidently, but with that degree of uncertainty. If I'm uncertain and you know that, you will share information with me. It's all in the way we carry ourselves. And so it's wonderful not to know. Again, everything becomes new.
And that this mindfulness for all women, I think, as women become more mindful, we tip the equilibrium of what is the rule? Who made the rule? Who gets to make the rules and why?
Yeah. And then you change it. So some things you can't change, but in the not changing, knowing how it came about in the first place is useful. So we take what is, we find good reason to make us think it had to be that way. It has to be that way. It's always been that way. Another example that I use, you know, you have insurance. Is the insurance company going to pay for the drug? Now, what rules are they using? So I use Viagra as an example. Now, imagine the people on the committee in the insurance, you know, making this decision are a group of lusty 50-year-old men. Versus the committee consists of a group of nuns. You know, the first group is this, yes, we should pay for it. The second group, no. So what does that mean? That means when something that is doesn't meet our needs, don't back off.
Right.
Because when you push it, then it's clear that it's not sitting based on irrefutable data. Because all the data, again, when we ever talk data, are probability. If you follow what I write about fully, you come to see that everything is mutable, everything. And that's not the way we're brought up. When I was a kid, the first time I gave a lecture, I walk into this room and the stage is here and the chairs start back here. Too far away and I'm nervous. What did I do? I moved the chairs. But most people wouldn't think to do that. You know, that everything can be changed. Now, for women, this is even more important than for men. When I'm giving some lectures, I'll see somebody very tall in the audience, always a 6'5" guy. I don't know why. I'll ask him to come to the stage. So there he is at 6'5", and here I am at 5'3". We look funny. I'll ask him to put his hand up. We'll put his hand up. His hand is 3 inches larger than mine. And then I just raised the question, should we do anything the same way? Anything physical? No. Now, if he created the how to do, it's not going to serve me well to mindlessly do it the way he said, because we're too different. All right.
And this is the culture we live in though, right?
Yeah. No, and always have. And I think that part of the reason is that it sustains the status quo. It's as if he or whoever on top deserves to be there, as if they know things now we know they don't know. So as a rule, I think the more different you are from the person who wrote the rule, the more important it is for you to change how you're doing it. We walk into a room and virtually everything that is there seems to be there for some stable reason. And it's everything was once a decision and means there was uncertainty and means there were people who made this decision that met their needs that may not meet the needs anymore. I have a mindfulness scale. How moronic would it be for me to do poorly on this scale? So the more similar you're going to be to me, the better you're going to do. And that's the case with everything. Everything. People don't understand everything is mutable. Sometimes you're going to win and sometimes not, but the game is fun. Recognizing that everything that's put in front of you was to please some people. And if it doesn't please you, change it.
So we asked this question, what is your wish for every other woman?
When you're mindful, you get to see advantages to which other people are blind. You avoid the pit holes, again, that other people are oblivious to. You have all sorts of choices, and you don't need to make those choices because whatever you're experiencing, you recognize will feel good. you can fight the fight and still enjoy the day.
Be visible. Use your voice. Every other woman needs you to lead. Voice Lessons is co-produced, written, and spoken by me, Kim Cutable. It's also co-produced and edited by Sergio Miranda. You can find past episodes, show notes, and the cool stuff our guests recommend at voicelessonspodcast.com.